So this talk will be about how measurements can give rise to new classes of long-range entangled states. Usually we think of measurement as something you do at the very end of an experiment. You read out some data and that's it. But I hope to convince you in the course of this talk that if you think about measurements as actually part of the dynamics of some evolving quantum system, you can actually get some interesting new physics from that. So first, let me point out what I mean by long-range entangled quantum matter first. Very roughly speaking, long-range entangled states are states that are very far from classical product-like states. So in that sense, they're kind of the most interesting because they're the farthest from our everyday classical intuition. So one very prominent example is quantum criticality. These are states that can occur at phase transitions between different competing orders, say ferromagnetic versus paramagnetic order. And the competition between these different phases can lead to quantum correlations at all length scales. Another prominent example is topological order. So unlike more conventional orders like ferromagnets, topological order is not simply characterized by any local order parameter. And instead, one needs to dig deeper, and there's even more fascinating phenomena such as these fractionalized excitations or anions, which can be neither bosonic nor fermionic. So I think given all these fascinating properties, it's clear that we like to see as much of this physics as possible in real materials, in real experiments. And you know, these are not only fascinating themselves, but they actually might be useful for things like quantum computation. So in the past couple of decades, there have been several successes at realizing topological quantum materials, but of a very different kind. Okay, so I think most of you have already heard about topological insulators at some point. These are bulk insulators with metallic surface states, and these metallic surface states are robust as long as one enforces or demands the presence of time reversal symmetry. And so by now, this type of phenomenon has been seen in a variety of materials, experiments, by now. And during my PhD, I and several collaborators and my advisor predicted a class of topological crystalline insulators, which, like topological insulators, also have interesting metallic surface states. But now these are protected not by time reversal symmetry, but by some crystalline symmetries, such as a crystal mirror symmetry. And similarly, these have also, this type of phenomenon has also been seen in numerous experiments by now. So this is all quite interesting physics. However, it's important to note that this is not the topological order. This is not the long-range entangled matter I talked about on the previous slide. And in particular, there are no fractionalized anion type excitations in these systems. And indeed, it's been very challenging to find instances of long-range entangled matter in solid-state materials. But in the past couple of years, there's been a lot of amazing progress in the sphere of quantum simulators and quantum computers. And these have demonstrated enormous potential for serving as a new venue for realizing long-range entangled states. So in fact, there's already been realization of several different kinds of topological order in a variety of these quantum hardware systems, ranging from Rydberg atom arrays to trapped ions to superconducting qubits. So these quantum hardwares are basically highly controllable systems where one can literally build up a many-body wave function from scratch. So more precisely, you can carry out some quantum circuit consisting of unitary operations, which can transform some trivial initial product state into some target many-body state of interest. And this is precisely what we did in collaboration with Chris Monroe's trapped ion group to carry out some of our protocols for realizing quantum critical and thermofield double states. OK, so this is quite exciting. However, again, there's an important caveat that what makes long-range entangled states very interesting also makes them hard to prepare, almost by definition. So I said at the beginning that these long-range entangled states are very far from classical product states. And more precisely, what this means is that they cannot be prepared from trivial product states using local unitary quantum circuits with finite depth or constant depth, basically depth that does not increase with the size of the system. Okay. So why is this the case? Well, this is because for any local unitary circuit, there's a finite speed at which correlations can be generated. It takes some time before one can establish correlations between two different sites. So what this means is that in order to prepare the desired long-range correlation, long-range entanglement, one needs a circuit, a unitary circuit, with depth or evolution time that increases with the system size. So even for a quantum simulator or quantum computer, it's still hard to generate these long-range entangled states because one ideally wants to prepare a macroscopic state, but this requires extensive time. And in the meantime, noise and decoherence might mess things up. Okay, so it's important to note that this type of bound assumes a circuit made out of local unitary gates, right? But we know from basic quantum mechanics that we not only have unitary time evolution, but we also have this weird thing called projective measurement, right? So this begs the question, can we use local measurements to kind of bypass these bounds? Can we use local measurements and possibly some classical communication to get around these constraints on preparing long-range entangled states? Are there more efficient protocols using measurements? And more generally, are there interesting types of dynamics involving measurements which can give rise to new long-range entangled states we haven't even imagined before? So this is not simply an academic question. Many quantum hardware groups already have the capability of performing intermediate measurement and then using the measurement outcome to do something in the future. Okay, so this is a basic primitive of quantum error correction, fault tolerance, and so many groups are indeed working on this such type of measurement circuits. Okay, so I think all of you already know about a very basic example in which measurements play a very important role at doing something non-trivial, and that's just quantum teleportation. Let me just briefly remind you how this works. So say we have two parties, Alice and Bob, that are they're very far apart, and let's say Alice has two qubits, Bob has one qubit, and let's say Alice's second qubit is entangled with Bob's in this EPR or Bell pair, 0, 0 plus 1, 1. And let's say that Alice wishes to send Bob her first qubit without actually having to physically move this qubit a long distance. So the teleportation protocol involves Alice performing a Bell pair measurement on her two qubits. So she measures ZZ and XX on her two qubits. And this will collapse her two qubits into a Bell pair. And if she obtains the Bell pair result 0, 0 plus 1, 1, then one can easily check that after that measurement is performed, Bob will have his qubit in the state of Alice's first qubit. And even if Alice obtained a different measurement outcome, like some other Bell pair, what she can do is communicate that outcome of her measurement, which is just some classical information, to Bob, and Bob can apply some simple operator to recover the state of Alice's qubit. Okay, so this is a very simple few-body example where measurement followed by classical communication and feedback can do something very non-trivial. It can transmit quantum information. So this talk will be about basically measurements now in a many-body, not few-body setting. So more specifically, in the first part, I'll describe how competition between different types of measurements can give rise to new types of long-range entangled states. And in the second part, I'll talk about how measurements followed by feedback, basically using the measurement outcomes to decide what future operations to perform, can prepare many different classes of long-range entangled states more efficiently than protocols only involving unitary operations. And finally, in the third part, I'll talk about how even noise, which is just measurement followed by forgetting the outcome, can transform existing long-range entanglement in a state in some highly non-trivial ways. So this is the plan of the talk. So let me just jump right into the first part, which is work done with my student, Shengji. So the context of our work was a very active area of research called hybrid quantum circuits. So very, very quickly, hybrid quantum circuits is some type of quantum dynamics involving a system of qubits where one has both unitary time evolution. So here each blue box represents a random unitary gate, as well as projective measurements, whereby a qubit is measured, collapses into a particular state that's decoupled from the rest of the system. So for every black dot here, one is performing a projective measurement on a qubit with some probability p. P here is the rate of measurement. Okay. So we're interested in properties of the long time steady state from this dynamics, namely how entangled is the steady state. And as you can probably guess, how entangled the steady state is depends precisely on this rate of measurement p. Okay. So when the rate of measurement is small, the unitaries are dominating the dynamics, and the unitaries tend to entangle everything together. So this is the entangling phase. On the other hand, when the rate of measurement is high, then all these frequent measurements are constantly collapsing the state into some product-like state with very low entanglement. So this is the disentangling phase. Okay. So more quantitatively, if you look at the steady state of the circuit, then in the entangling phase, the steady state has volume law scaling of entanglement. If I partition the steady state into a region A and its complement, then the amount of entanglement scales linearly with the size of A. And in contrast, the disentangling phase, for the disentangling phase, the steady state has area law entanglement. The amount of entanglement does not scale with the size of A, just some order one number. So there's this fascinating entanglement phase transition between volume law and area law at a particular critical rate of measurement PC. So this type of dynamics is probably all too familiar to all of us in this COVID era. One can imagine just replacing the unitary by community spread, competing with our testing isolation. So hopefully we're in this area law phase for the foreseeable future. Okay, so surprisingly, what we found is that even without any unitary dynamics at all, even with only measurements, one can already produce a very interesting long-range entangled state. Okay, so let me walk you through a toy model illustrating this physics. So the toy model is as follows. Let's say we have a 1D chain of qubits that's initialized in some product state plus. And the dynamics is very simple. We either measure a single qubit in the x direction, or we perform a ZZ measurement on two nearest neighbor qubits. So we perform a parity measurement that tells whether two qubits are aligned or opposite in the Z basis. That's it. This dynamics just consists of these two types of operations. So just as how different interactions in a Hamiltonian can compete to give rise to quantum criticality, we'll see that these two different types of measurements can also compete and give rise to a steady state that's critical. Okay. So let's first consider the two extreme limits of this type of dynamics. So first, let's consider what happens when we only have ZZ measurements, so no X measurements at all. Okay. Then every pair of qubits is being measured with a ZZ operator. And so the steady state just consists of a state with ZZ equal plus or minus one for every neighboring pair of qubits. Okay, so the steady state is just a random Schrodinger cat type state. It's some random configuration of spins plus the flipped counterpart. So that's a random cat I found on the internet. And in contrast, for the X measurement case, if I only have X measurement, then every qubit is measured in the X basis, and this is manifestly a trivial product state. Okay, so those are the two extreme limits. And now we want to see what happens in between, away from the limits. So to do that, we want to consider some kind of order parameter that quantifies what we mean by this random cat type order, right? So let me first say that this random cat type order is more formally known as a spin glass. This is basically because there's no conventional magnetic order here. All the ZZ correlations are plus or minus one. This averages out to zero. So instead, we need a more subtle spin glass order parameter that basically involves the square of the ZZ correlations. Yeah, so now these plus or minus one values square to one, and these ones add coherently. So this type of spin glass order now can distinguish the two different phases. In the spin glass phase, this order parameter will scale extensively with system size. One can check that for this ideal random cat state, this order parameter is exactly L. And on the other hand, for the paramagnetic phase, this order parameter will be some constant that's independent of system size. So now with this order parameter in hand, we can map out the phase diagram for this model, which is quite simple. So when the ZZ measurements are more frequent, we find that the steady state of this dynamics is in the spin glass phase. It has an extensive order parameter. And on the other hand, when the X measurements dominate, we have this paramagnetic phase where the order parameter is order one number. And we have this phase transition between these phases right when the probability of ZZ measurement and the probability of X measurement are equal. Okay. So it's important to note that the Ising or global spin flip symmetry in this type of dynamics is very important here. For example, if I consider doing a Z measurement, which breaks the Ising symmetry, then this will immediately collapse this random cat state to a product state. Right? So the Ising symmetry is essential in having a stable spin glass phase. All right, so now we'd like to understand the nature of this critical point in more detail.
Sorry, just so that I follow.
Yeah.
ZZ acts on plus plus, giving minus minus. Is it true?
ZZ plus plus, yes, right.
So when I act with ZZ on two sides, I just flip them.
If you're writing in the X basis, yes, sure.
Just a little bit. And then if I act again on minus minus, I'm just confused why do I get two states? Why don't I start, if I act once, I thought I just flipped two sides.
You're asking about how we get this random cat state.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I should have explained that more. So the initial state is the all plus state,
yeah,
which is superposition of all configurations in the Z basis, right?
Because now these arrows are in the Z basis.
This is in the Z basis, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. So one always has this Ising symmetry that relates up to down throughout this dynamics.
I thought it was in the X basis. I was confused.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Sorry.
Just one other question about this transition.
Mm-hmm.
Does it correspond to like some other transition that's known, like an entanglement transition, like a purification transition, or is this some like new type of phase transition you see in these circuits?
Well, so it's not really an entanglement phase transition, because here the two different phases, they both have area law scaling of entanglement. So it's more like a akin to like a ground state ordering disorder phase transition. But I don't think it has any equilibrium counterpart. Like I would, you know, it would be hard to realize this critical point in some ground state of a Hamiltonian, I think. Okay, so the goal now is to understand this phase transition in more detail. So for that purpose, it's useful to perform what's called the Jordan-Wigner transformation, which represents each spin or qubit as some pair of Majorana fermions gamma. So we like to translate all this qubit or spin language into a Majorana picture. We like to see what all these operations correspond to.
Sorry, I still have one right now.
Yeah, sure.
But X acting on all plus gives just all plus, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So when you say that when I have just X, does nothing, right? If I start with all plus and I just do X operations, I do nothing, right?
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
The ZZ ones are the ones building up this non-trivial state. Yeah. Right, so we'd like to translate all these qubit operations into Majorana language. And so it's pretty easy to check that measuring a qubit in the X basis corresponds to measuring the fermion parity of the two Marannas making up that qubit. And so I've denoted this fermion parity measurement by this diagram here, because what it means is that these two Marannas making up the qubit are being projected into some definite state, and then this definite state is further propagating forward in time. Okay. And similarly, the ZZ measurement in qubit language maps to a fermion parity measurement for a different pair of Marannas in the system. And the identity gate, or identity or trivial evolution, just corresponds to Marannas individually propagating forward in time. So now one can literally replace this quantum circuit picture with the Marana picture, which is just all these Marana world lines. So what we see is that this critical point in which ZZ and X occur with equal probability now maps to a classical loop model in the critical percolation universality class. And a lot is known about percolation, and we can just extract many properties of the steady state from properties of percolation. In particular, we find that at this critical point, the entanglement of the steady state has a logarithmic scaling with a subregion of size LA, which is typical for 1 plus 1 critical points. Okay, so this is just a very simple toy model, giving you a flavor of how, even with measurements only, competing measurements can give rise to some interesting long-range entangled states. So things get even more interesting when you add unitary evolution to this toy model.
Sorry, just a question.
And yeah.
You probably even have a continuum limit, right, in that case?
Sorry, which?
There's probably even a continuum field theory limit, right?
Yeah, it's percolation is described by some non-unitary CFT. Yeah.
Which is fine, because here we are measuring stuff, so it's also very non-unitary.
Exactly. The measurements usually end up flowing to some non-unitary CFT. Yeah, it's literally non-unitary, right? Yeah.
Nice.
Okay, so, yeah.
The coefficient from logarithm subsystem gives you some central charge.
So for non-unitary CFT, it's pretty tricky, because the coefficient usually doesn't correspond to the central charge. Like, the central charge for many non-unitary theories is zero, right? So usually this is some other quantity. Like, in this case, I think it depends on the scaling dimension of some vertex operators in CFD. Okay, so now we like to see what happens when we add unitaries to this toy model. So as I said before, the global Ising or spin flip symmetry is essential in having a stable spin glass in this phase diagram. So we'd like to demand that any random unitary gate we add respect this global Ising symmetry. So now with some probability of performing a unitary gate, we have an even richer phase diagram that's not only parameterized by the rate of ZZ versus X measurement, but also parameterized by the rate of unitaries versus measurement. So here's the 1D phase diagram I showed before, the transition from spin glass to paramagnet, with the critical point described by percolation. And then now, with some unitaries in the mix, with enough unitaries, one gets this volume law entangled phase I alluded to earlier. And these entanglement transitions from area to volume law can now actually simultaneously occur with order-disorder phase transitions. So long story short, one gets quite interesting non-equilibrium universality classes that have yet to be fully understood. This is all arising from some dynamics involving measurements and unitaries in the presence of some global symmetries. Okay, so that's all I want to say about the first part. Maybe I can just pause for any questions there.
Is that the critical region, or is there?
Yeah, so this is somewhat ambiguous from our numerics. From what we can tell, this is really some critical region. But we cannot rule out that this is some finite size effect that will converge all three phase boundaries in thermodynamic limit. This is still somewhat ambiguous. Yeah. Okay, so in the second part of the talk, I'd like to switch gears and show you how measurements and using the measurement outcomes can be used to prepare long-range entangled states much more efficiently than just purely unitary schemes. So this is work done with a postdoc here, Peter, Leo, who's a PhD student, and Isaac from UC Davis. So in this part of the talk, we'd like to consider local adaptive circuits, which are very similar to before, like the hybrid quantum circuits. They also involve local unitaries, local measurements. But now the key addition is that we allow for using the result of the measurement outcomes to do some classical processing that allows us to determine what operations to apply in the future. Okay, so hence the name adaptive. We can now have future operations depend on previous measurement outcomes.
So can I ask just a general question?
Yeah.
Whenever you talk about these measurements that you do on purpose, is there some connection to the measurements that one does by accident, by having environment and system?
It's a good question. That type of measurement I will talk about in the third part of the talk. In this type of measurement, it's really like a very, you can say, controlled measurement where, you know, I have the outcome and I make use of the outcome. Whereas for an environmental measurement, the environment is measuring it, but that measurement outcome is kind of lost, right? So one does not have a definite pure state after that type of measurement.
I think I missed this part. Where do you use the outcome so far?
Here I've just kind of outlined the general structure of an adaptive circuit.
In the previous part, no.
In the previous part, no. Yeah. This is good to clarify. In the first part, we're not using the measurement outcome at all. Mm-hmm. Here we are more along the lines of teleportation, right? In teleportation, we are also using the result, right? Yeah. Okay, so so this local adaptive circuit is defined by local unitaries, local measurements, and this classical communication of the measurement outcomes to some classical computer that can then inform us what operations to apply later. And again, this is a pretty realistic setting to consider because for a lot of the quantum hardwares, the quantum operations, the measurements, the unitaries are the ones that are hard. It's the classical part that's relatively easy. And so it's pretty realistic to assume that, you know, we can have this non-local classical communication, whereas the unitary's measurements themselves are local. So in this work, we basically come up with three classes of local adaptive circuits that are motivated by different principles in physics to basically prepare many classes of long-range entangled states. So in the interest of time, I'll just focus primarily on the renormalization-based approach. But let me just briefly say that each of these approaches has some advantages. So the tensor network approach, which basically uses measurements to literally stitch together a many-body wave function, has the advantage that it's a modular approach that's quite practical for experiments. On the other hand, the parton-based approach, which uses measurements to enforce gauge constraints, has the advantage that it can be used to efficiently prepare chiral topological order states like the fractional quantum Hall effect. And the renormalization-based approach, which I'll talk about in more detail, has the advantage that it can prepare quantum critical states and many exotic topological orders, including those hosting non-abelian anions, quite efficiently. Okay, so this is one I'll focus on. Again, just to give you a flavor of how measurement and feedback is useful for this purpose. Okay, so I'm assuming Giffrey has indoctrinated all of you with Mera at some point. So I'll be relatively brief in this background. Let me just say that Mera is a way to coarse grain the system by disentangling qubits from the many body wave function, and this leaves fewer and fewer degrees of freedom, those that are most relevant for the long distance physics of the state. So and given the tree-like structure, given a system of length L, this Mera has depth log L. So viewed from going from bottom to top, this Mera is some renormalization procedure. However, going from top to bottom, this Mera can be viewed as some unitary circuit that prepares a many-body state from a trivial product state, this all zero state. Okay. However, an important catch is that this unitary circuit involves non-local unitary gates. As you can see, high up in the circuit, there are these unitaries that couple degrees of freedom that are very far apart. Okay. And so such non-local unitary gates might be hard to achieve in practice. So this is a natural place where measurement and feedback can help out. So if you recall the teleportation I described at the beginning of the talk, each non-local unitary gate can be converted into some finite depth adaptive circuit by just using teleportation, right? So very heuristically, one can teleport a qubit using measurement and feedback near a faraway qubit, carry out the desired unitary operation, and then use measurement and feedback to teleport that qubit back. So this is a way to transform all non-local unitary gates into some order one depth adaptive circuit. So this can be done for all these non-local unitary gates. And so now this MERA just results in some log depth, completely local adaptive circuit. Okay. And this scheme can be used to prepare any state that MERA efficiently captures. So MERA is known to capture quantum critical states, also different types of topological order with both abelian, non-abelian anions. And so what this trick allows for is some local adaptive circuit which prepares all of these states using only depth log L. And I think for many of these states, including some quantum critical non-abelian topological orders, this log L is believed to be optimal. Yeah.
So for this teleportation trick to work, do you need the gate to be still bi-local or any arbitrary non-local thing?
Right. So I think it's still important that it's a k-local, right? So like a order one number of degrees of freedom are interacting.
And
yeah.
That's true for MERA.
That is true for MERA, right? Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. So this reduction of using measurement feedback for teleportation and MERA allows us to construct many states of interest with only log L depth, as opposed to for using a local unitary circuit, this would require order L depth to prepare many of these. Okay, so so I think local adaptive circuits have a lot of potential both in experiments and in many theoretical questions. So as I said, many of these quantum hardwares have this ability to perform intermediate measurement and feedback. And so indeed, we recently collaborated with Quantinuum, which is a leading trapped ion quantum computing group, to implement this type of local adaptive circuit for preparing a long-range entangled state called the surface code. And on the theory front, these local adaptive circuits can be used to prepare many long-range entangled mixed states, right? So in this previous MERA scheme, that allows you to prepare some long-range entangled pure state of interest. And that's because when you're doing all the measurements, you create all these branches of the wave function, and then the feedback in the MERA case converges them all to a target pure state, right? But this is kind of fine-tuned, and the more general setting is when you have measurements creating all these trajectories, and then the feedback is not able to converge all the trajectories to a pure state, but it's allowed to provide enough order that it's not a trivial ensemble. Okay, so basically this type of local adaptive circuit can be used to prepare interesting mixed states as well, which we found in this recent work. And one example of this is a local adaptive circuit that converts an integer quantum Hall system, which is a gapped phase with exponentially decaying correlations, to some quantum critical mixed state with power law decaying correlations. Okay, so this kind of illustrates the power of local adaptive circuit in manipulating phases of matter. Okay, that was a admittedly fast overview of the adaptive circuit, but that's all I wanted to say about the second portion. I can pause for some questions for this. All right, okay. So in this third part, I'll talk about a different kind of measurement, a more natural kind of measurement that Pedro alluded to earlier. And this more natural kind of measurement, which is basically just noise, as you'll see, can also produce long-range entangled mixed states that are interesting. Okay, so this is work done with Yi Zhen, who's a postdoc here, and Shengji. And we're interested in the question of how the long-range entanglement in quantum critical pure states is affected by noise. Okay, so here, by noise or decoherence, I mean the environment performing a measurement and then just forgetting about the outcome. Okay, and you know, you might think that noise is you know, always bad, right? Noise just, you know, decoheres everything. It becomes trivially classical. Like, why should I care? But as you'll see, noise can be more interesting than that. So I think this is probably the most technical part of the talk. So let me just state the punchlines first. So what we find is that one can define a notion of RG flows for quantum channels describing the noise. Okay, so there's a precise notion in which some noise is more relevant or irrelevant than other types of noise. And then we'll use this RG framework to determine the entanglement structure of the mixed states resulting from decohering a quantum critical point. Okay, and we'll find that, you know, noise is not always bad. It can actually transform the long-range entanglement of the critical state in some interesting ways. Okay, so here's the precise setup we want to consider. We want to model the noise as some local quantum channel, basically a tensor product of single qubit quantum channels. And for concreteness, the type of quantum channel we will consider is some dephasing channel. Basically, each single qubit channel is dephasing in some direction v with strength p. Okay. And the dephasing channel is quite simple. All it does is it flips a qubit in the v direction with some probability p over 2, or it does nothing. Okay. And this dephasing channel can also be understood as performing a measurement in the v direction with some probability p over 2, or doing nothing. So this is what I meant by the noise acting as environmental measurement, and then forgetting about or averaging over the different possible measurement outcomes. So as you can see, this type of dephasing, or in general quantum channels, usually just transform pure states into mixed states because you're averaging over the different possible measurement outcomes. So we want to see what happens when we apply this type of noise to a critical pure state described by some conformal field theory. And more precisely, we want to understand the entanglement structure of this resulting mixed state. Okay. Okay, so the first important step is to map the action of this quantum channel to some boundary condition on several copies of the conformal field theory. So say we're interested in some Rennie entanglement quantity of this mixed state. So here I've illustrated this by some nth Rennie entropy of some subsystem A, which is just given by this. Here, rho A is the reduced density matrix on A. And so what we find is that this trace rho A to the n quantity can also be understood as some wave function overlap between two n copies of the CFT and some boundary state that depends on which channel n was applied. Okay, so this is a pretty straightforward statement. Somewhat technical, so I've opted to skip the details. But the long story short is that this channel gets mapped to some boundary condition on several copies of the CFT for the purpose of calculating some Rennie entanglement quantity. Okay, and this type of mapping works for many entanglement measures of interest. For example, one might want to consider Rennie entanglement negativity, which is an important measure for quantum correlations for a mixed state. Okay? And this too can be mapped to some wave function overlap between two n copies of the CFT and some boundary condition depending on the channel n. Okay. So the upshot of this is that to understand the long distance entanglement structure of this mixed state row, that question now reduces to understanding what does this boundary condition flow to in the IR, right?
What
is curly n? Curly n here is curly n. Where is curly n?
In the north channel.
Curly channel. Curly n is the north channel. Yeah, right.
Sorry, what? Should I know what the north channel is?
I was a bit fast with that here.
That was the definition.
Sorry. This is a global noise channel. It's just a tensor product of single qubit noise channels. Each single qubit noise channel we take to be a defacing channel of this form. And the most important parameters here are V, the direction of the defacing, like whether you flip in the X, Y, or Z direction, for example, and also this parameter P, which is the strength of the noise.
I see. So
this
D is N.
This D is N, yeah, sorry. It's, kind of bad notation.
So on
yeah.
each side.
On each side, you apply this. Yes. Right.
In both channels, I take a basic matrix and I spit out the basic matrix.
Yeah, exactly. The defacing channel acts on some arbitrary state, pure or mixed, and it spits out another, in general, mixed state. Yeah. Yeah. We want to understand this mixed state that it spits out. How entangled is it?
And this product means I do it L times.
This product just means you're doing this independently on every qubit in your system.
I see. And it commutes trivially.
They all commute, right? Okay.
Do you just apply the channel one time on the state?
Or? Yeah. So in this case, we're applying it one time.
State.
Exactly. Right. So in contrast to the first part of the talk, we're not considering some noisy dynamics. We're considering just the effect of like a one-shot noise on this critical state. But as you'll see, even that can be interesting. Right? Yeah, so I've just kind of outlined here the mapping of a channel to a boundary condition for CFT states. And so now the plan is just to kind of borrow the powerful technology of boundary conformal field theory to understand the entanglement structure of this mixed state row. Okay. For example, what we can do is we can compute just the second Reni entropy of the entire system. Okay, so we take this decoherent critical state row, and we just look at the Reni entropy of the entire system. That's minus log trace rho squared. And what we find is that it has this extensive piece, which is not surprising because every qubit in the system is getting some noise, right? So it has this extensive entropy, it's a leading term. But more importantly, it has this universal subleading piece, log g, where g is nothing but the boundary entropy corresponding to the boundary condition that the channel determines. Okay. So, I should say I'm hardly an expert on G function, boundary entropy, et cetera. So let me be brief and just, I guess, highlighting the essential physics of G. So G plays a similar role for boundary RG flow as the central charge C does for bulk RG flow. And in particular, a channel corresponding to a boundary condition with larger G can flow to a channel with boundary condition with smaller g, but not vice versa. So there's this usual monotonicity condition for RG flow. Okay, so let's see how all this plays out for a specific example. That's probably one of the simplest critical states, just a 1D transistorializing critical point. Okay, so on the lattice, we consider this this classic Hamiltonian, just the Ising interaction with the transverse field tuned to the critical point. So this is described, this ground state is described by Ising CFT in the continuum. And we want to understand the effect of defacing in different directions for this simple example. So what we find is that this depends sensitively on the direction of defacing. Okay, so we find that defacing in the x direction is relevant with log g equals minus log 2. Defacing in the zx plane is even more relevant. And in contrast, defacing in the z direction is a marginal perturbation, which results in some continuous set of fixed points that's parameterized by the strength of the channel, p. Okay, so this is the RG flows we see for defacing in different directions for Ising CFD.
Do you guys look at that with, was it always a 1 in terms of the external field strength? And if you varied that, do you think the angle would change that it was most important at?
Sorry, what do you want to vary here?
Like, say, like, you vary the field strength in your Ising model, do you think that would change what direction that value there would be the largest? It's like script D. Like, right now, it's maximizing you align, like, when you're aligned with the Z and X axis. Do you think that's just because the coefficients in front of the Z and X terms match, or... or is that maybe like not relevant to that?
So you want to perturb this field, but stay on the critical point, you mean? Or
yeah, well, I'm saying that you play with the strength of the external field, so you get to like to see like how that affects the log g term. Like, I mean, if you like blast it, then you're probably going to go back to like your dz case. Like, if that field was huge, it would dominate, right? So there's like, you have this other field you could kind of like play with, another variable you could play with, and see how it affects d. Do you know what I mean?
I'm not sure what I understand. So, I mean, these directions clearly depend on the convention for the Hamiltonian. If you perturb the field but demand remaining on the critical point, then you'll have some local unitary basis change that will then change these values, these directions as well. Yeah.
Doing what you said would make the theory gaps, right?
Yeah. If you just change this coefficient here, you'll gap out the critical point, yeah. Okay, so let's see what the consequences are for this RG flows for the entanglement structure for rho, okay? Again, for mixed states, one wants to look at a good measure of mixed state entanglement, and entanglement negativity is one such measure. So, We look at this decoherent critical state rho, we partition it into region A and its complement, and we want to look at the entanglement scaling between A and its complement. So let's first look at defacing in the x direction. If we don't have any defacing at all when p equals 0, we just have the original CFT that has the well-known logarithmic entanglement scaling with the size of A, right? That's shown here. However, when we turn on even a little bit of defacing, say p equals 0.1 or 0.2, we see that the entanglement scaling collapses immediately to area loss scaling, right? And this is consistent with what we found with the g function, which suggested that the x defacing is a relevant perturbation, right? What this means is that if we turn on a small amount of this channel, it will flow at long distance to maximal defacing in that direction. And we know that maximal defacing will just lead to a completely classical ensemble with no long-range entanglement at all, right? And in contrast, this is what happens when we turn on z defacing with different strengths. So we see that now, for different strengths of defacing, we still maintain the log scaling of the entanglement. However, the coefficient of the log now decreases continuously all the way down to 0 when we have maximal defacing in the z direction. Okay, so this is again consistent with z defacing being a marginal perturbation leading to this continuous set of fixed points. And interestingly, we find that defacing in the y direction turns out to be an irrelevant perturbation. This can be seen from our numerics here. So if we have some strength of defacing that's, say, less than some threshold value of around 0.5 or 0.6, we see that the entanglement of this mixed state not only maintains the logarithmic scaling with size of LA, but even the coefficient of that log remains the same as for the pure CFD, right? So what it means is somehow for weak defacing in the y direction at long distances, it's as if the channel did not act at all. Right. It has the same properties as the pure CFD.
Sorry, can you translate statements to the continuum, or do they tell us something about the, just the MPIs-ing CFD? There are some defects that do nothing. And...
Yeah. So I think the upshot of this whole work is just that this is another like physical motivation for considering boundary conditions of several copies of the CFD, or if you want, maybe equivalently some defects in CFDs, right? So I'm not sure we learned anything new about the field theories. In fact, we need to import the field theory results to learn about the entanglement, right? So from what I understand, the boundary conditions when you have several copies of CFD often are still not completely understood, right? So I think our work doesn't really shed light on that question, but we get more motivation for understanding those boundary conditions. Yeah.
So this is supposed to the quadratic entropy?
Sorry?
This is the quadratic entropy?
Sorry, the...
The second entropy?
Sorry. Okay, so for entanglement negativity is a little bit tricky. Let me go back to this slide. You might know that entanglement negativity involves computing the partial transpose of the density matrix, and then like looking at how many negative eigenvalues there are in the partial transpose. And so the entanglement negativity by itself is very hard to compute. So usually we compute the Renyi negativity, but to be sensitive to the negative eigenvalues, we need to look at an odd power of the partial transpose matrix. So that numerics that I showed is for the third Renyi negativity. Yeah.
These properties of relevant or irrelevant or not enough, do they depend on n?
That's a very good question. So in principle, they can. But what we found is that for all the Renyis, like greater than one, they all give consistent results for relevance, irrelevance, or marginality. However, when you analytically continue to get the desired entanglement negativity, that might change. Okay, so it's just our numerics for all the Renyis, they're consistent, but in principle they don't have to be.
So it's special that the Renyi is irrelevant and the entanglement will be relevant.
Yeah. So if you analytically continue, the conclusion might change. Yeah, we cannot rule that out. That's true, right? I think the Renyi entanglement measures are telling us something about the entanglement structure. Maybe not the ideal thing we want, but yeah.
Sorry, more physical. Can I think that I have my state that I diagonalized from? I had a spin chain, and I found, say, the ground state, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then I compute correlations, and I get power laws, amazing model.
Yeah.
But now, before I do these measurements, I do this dephasing, right?
Sure.
And I could do the dephasing in one direction,
mm-hmm.
and I still get the nice power laws, but if I do another dephasing, I destroy the state, and I get something wrong.
Yeah, this is an important question. So it turns out that correlation functions, like linear observables of the state, are actually not sensitive to a lot of this physics, because the local quantum channel cannot affect the long distance properties of correlation functions. It just locally dresses an operator, right? So it does not change the power law decay of correlation functions. However, it can change nonlinear properties like entanglement, right? So more concretely, let's say we take this X dephasing case. I showed you that for a small amount of p, the entanglement just collapses to almost unentangled, right? However, these states with p equals 0.1 or 0.2, they actually still have power law decaying correlations for like zz, xx, etc. Okay, so it's kind of counterintuitive that you have these states with power law decaying correlations in non-commuting bases, and yet you have very little entanglement, okay. But that's still consistent. Yeah. Okay. I think that's pretty much what I wanted to focus on in these three parts. So just to summarize, this talk is basically about using measurements in three different ways to get some interesting long-range entangled, both pure and mixed states. Right, so in the first part, I showed how competing measurements can give you some interesting long-range entangled states, some non-equilibrium critical states. In the second part, I outlined how measurement and feedback can prepare target long-range entangled states much faster. And finally, in the last part, I showed you how just environmental measurement or noise can actually be quite interesting. It can also lead to new classes of long-range entangled mixed states. So, you know, in the interest of keeping this talk at least somewhat coherent, I've just decided to focus on this area of research on measurement and decoherence-driven long-range entanglement. However, obviously, there's a lot more going on in the quantum sphere. There's a lot of stuff I haven't had a chance to talk about, like some practical approaches for quantum simulation, some more abstract questions, like understanding the complexity of many-body wave functions. And yeah, I should say I've had the nice fortune of collaborating with some great experimental groups, including Chris Monroe's trapped ion group and Quantinuum. And these, you know, these rapid experimental advances have really provided a lot of motivation for considering a lot of these settings of you know, measurement-driven dynamics, measurement and feedback. It poses a lot of interesting theoretical questions. For example, you know, one of my big goals is to find some example of dynamics involving measurement and feedback, some kind of continuous interplay between a quantum and a classical system, which can be used to generate and stabilize novel mixed states, right? So in some of these examples, I showed you, as one person asked, like a one-shot protocol of applying some noise channel, getting some mixed state of interest. But is there some dynamics involving, you know, communication of the classical outcome of the measurement to a classical system, and then feeding back, and then some interplay between that that allows one to stabilize new phases of matter? So this is along the spirit of quantum error correction, but I think there's a lot of merit in viewing this question from more quantum matter point of view. And yeah, and finally, you know, with all this measurement business, I think one inevitably is forced to think about the age-old measurement problem. What exactly is this measurement that I've been using for all three parts of the talk, right? I mean, yeah, still it's somewhat unsatisfying from a fundamental point of view. So I have some ideas of using some ideas from computational complexity for understanding, you know, what exactly is a measurement, but we'll see. So yeah, thanks for bearing with me through this talk, and let me thank all my collaborators in these three works.
In the example of dephasing channel, based on looking at only XYZ directions, can you see what happens in a general direction?
No, right? So,
so, I mean, for example, since the measurement in X direction is relevant, if we do in a random direction, then can we say, for example, the X part of the measurement contributes in a relevant way or something like that? Can we make it rigorous?
Well, I think it is rigorous. And like if you have only in the X direction, and then you add a little bit of dephasing in the Z direction, then this tells you that it will flow to the ZX boundary condition, right? So statements like that can be made.
What is this dephasing operation in the continuum again? I think I missed this point. Is it some time operator that I act on everywhere that acts on the state?
Yeah, let's see.
It's a problem. Sites, right? I do something.
It is some like tensor product over sites acting on some interval. if one's computing a Reni entropy of a subsystem, right? So, yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe the details here might help your question, but yeah.
I have a rather one question. So, what is do you have an analytical relation between the noise channel, directional noise channel, and the boundary entropy, or just the log two things coming from the numerics?
Yeah, yeah. So. The g functions I showed were mainly derived from numerics. However, there is a I still think it's a somewhat heuristic way to also see the relevance, irrelevance, or marginality of channels. So. There's another method that can be used. You can convert the mixed state into some operator state. So you can convert the density matrix into some pure state on two copies of the Hilbert space, right? And then the action of the channel now corresponds to some Euclidean time evolution with that operator you're defacing with. Like, so say defacing in the x direction means you're evolving in Euclidean time with x tensor x on two copies of the CFT. Right, and then you can look at the scaling dimension of what operators they correspond to in the continuum, and then you can also see that they're relevant, irrelevant, or marginal, okay, on the boundary, right. So this is one somewhat heuristic method. I say heuristic because there's no reason to expect why this dictates the entanglement properties of the original mixed state, right? Yeah, but somehow it seems to work, okay.
Is the way you introduce noise amenable to something like you could put in a circuit where you go back between unitaries and noise? So you could look at generic features and see how they maybe like resist noise in some kind of sense?
You want to kind of say something about the robustness of the CFD to noise?
Yeah,
right?
So like you have a way to put this noise in, and you put it in like one shot, but you're just going to back or like the noise comes like in waves, kind of like we do in a monitored quantum circuit, but replace the measurements with something.
Oh, I see. Noise. Yeah, so the challenge is that when you consider like an entire dynamics, like you know, let's say time scaling with system size, of applying this noisy quantum channel, typically that just trivializes the system no matter what it started out from, right? Here we are kind of relying on the one-shot nature of the noise. If you apply noise continuously, Then it will tend to make everything trivial, right?
I mean, like, it was kind of dependent on the noise model, no? Like, if you had like a U1 symmetry, and like dephasing, then you expect the dephasing to do nothing to your
right.
So I guess you could like play with different symmetries and different noises, no, and like see which resists.
Right. Yeah. Okay. There could be some non-trivial examples in that. Yeah. Yeah. This kind of ties to the last question I had. You know, some dynamics maybe involving measurement and feedback that can still produce some interesting mixed state, steady state.
For the first part of our talk, can you stabilize a Wallenau phase with some non-trivial order at the same time?
Coexistence
between the Wallenau entanglement and some interesting orders.
Volume law, yeah, okay. So yeah, I think even in our paper, we discussed one example where if you have like a 2+1 dynamics involving ZZ measurements and some unitaries, you can actually have an intermediate phase that's still volume law entangled, but still have a spin glass order.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so that's all like a, you know, a very non-equilibrium signature, because that would not be possible in, you know, 2+1 equilibrium. Right?
I see. But we don't know any example in 1+1 D.
1+1. Yeah, I'm not sure, yeah.
In the strange case of the exit phasing, where you get a quantum correlation, but still wear along, is this an intrinsic feature of the mixed state? Can you say like the quantum correlations became classical correlations in some sense?
Yeah, that is what this analysis, I think, is suggesting, right? Yeah, it means that despite ZZ and XX power law, like long-range correlations, that's not enough to say they're, you know, highly entangled, right?
It wouldn't happen if it was just pure states.
That's a good question. I don't think so. Yeah, like even for 2 qubits, you can construct like a mixed state where you have, you know, finite ZZ and XX correlation, but it's still completely classical, right? This is like a many-body instance of that. Yeah. Yeah.
So in the first part of the talk, like you refer to the problem of measurements at some point in the sort of statistical mechanics.
Right.
So was essentially, when you said that you hit criticality, say, would this be a statement that's true in the statistical mechanics sense, meaning that I can just ignore the fact that it came from measurements and study the statistical mechanics system and say it's critical?
Yeah. So it does map to some critical classical SAMMEC model, right? It's just I guess the kind of interesting thing is that, you know, we're asking about the entanglement properties of the steady state, and that might map to some different aspects of that classical SAMMEC model that we wouldn't have considered before, right? Like for percolation, it maps to like the number of strands that are going from interval A to the complement. Right. Okay, I guess that's still pretty natural from percolation consideration, but it can be more complicated than that simple model.
And when you add unitaries, there should be a statistical mechanics system which has non-positive statistical weights.
Yeah. Okay. So this. It's a good question. The mapping to the classical SAMMEC model is kind of subtle. Okay, so this particular mapping to percolation, you know, might be more specific to this ZZX measurement example. In general, what is done is when you have a circuit with measurement and unitary, you want to average over the randomness of that local unitary. So when you average over that randomness, then you map to some SAMMEC model that actually is like a proper SAMMEC model with positive, not negative weights, right? So it's subtle, like how that unitary gets mapped over.
But everything is done after computing things, right?
So
like a SAMMEC system which has no positive weights and disorder.
Yeah, so one wants to compute some entanglement quantity averaged over the local randomness. There is some subtle order of limits in that. Yeah, I'm not quite remembering at this moment, but yeah. It's a good question.
No, this diagram with intermediate region should be told as a phase diagram. System.
Right. Yeah, I should say that this critical region is pretty common for free fermion circuits, right? So in this case, I added some like arbitrary random unitary. If you restrict the free fermion unitaries, like what ones that preserve the Gaussian, you know, nature of the state, then it's actually quite common to get critical regions. So those are actually understood. Better. Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay. We can take the speaker again.